that $325 million that Fairbanks got to do this, it is a darn good start. And by the way, it's the only start we've ever had.
A big energy project for interior Alaska moves forward. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, stolen identities end in a federal fraud bust.
This was one of the more successful mail fraud rings that we have charged in this district, specifically in Anchorage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
6 Anchorage residents have been charged in a large mail fraud case. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ani Stewart says the suspects used altered checks from stolen mail and stolen vehicles in order to defraud various banks and stores throughout Anchorage, all while using stolen identities.
The allegations tend to show that this was one of the more successful mail fraud rings that we have charged in this district, specifically in Anchorage.
Stewart says between stolen checks and stolen identities, there were nearly 200 victims in the fraud case. 2 of the defendants, Sarah and Jonathan James, had court hearings today at the federal building in Anchorage. Another 2 defendants, Braden Ashbury and Carrie Embach, are also in custody. 2 of the defendants remain at large. The fate of the long-pursued Interior Energy Project will soon come into better focus. The state-funded effort hinges on a natural gas supply from Cook Inlet, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that's expected next month.
The North Star Borough voter-formed Interior Gas Utility is a utility without any gas to sell, but IGU General Manager Jomo Stewart says a forthcoming contract with a Cook Inlet producer could change that. Stewart says he can't yet share details, but the contract is central to presentations planned for a September 5th IGU board meeting.
We already have scheduled at our next board meeting to get the first run of financial modeling for this project as it will stand, having secured a gas supply.
The over $300 million state-financed Interior Energy Project calls for the IGU to purchase and merge with local gas utility Fairbanks Natural Gas. FNG currently trucks in Cook Inlet gas for over 1,000 local customers, but is poised to grow if more gas can be secured and the merger goes through. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority purchased FNG's parent company, Pentex, in anticipation of financing its resale to the IGU. Stewart says that's still the plan, as long as the gas contract comes in at a good price.
You wouldn't want to move forward on the purchase of this kind of major investment and accepting that kind of debt load in the absence of definition on things like what's the gas supply cost.
Stewart notes numerous other moving parts that need to be nailed down, including the cost of expanding Cook Inlet LNG processing, transport to and storage in the Fairbanks area, as well as local demand projections.
Getting that definition is actually what's in the offing now. And so over the course of the next, say, certainly over the course of the next month and a half, that information that has been generated is going to start to become public.
The Interior Energy Project is aimed at increasing local availability of gas as a cleaner, potentially cheaper alternative to oil, coal, and wood. Stewart cautions that it has to pencil out.
We're not going to want to move forward on a knife edge.
In this case, I think the glass is more than half full.
Borough Assemblymember John Davies is optimistic that the Interior Energy Project can succeed and reminds the public that a lot has gone into getting to this point, and it's important to see the project through.
The problem I see is that the history of Fairbanks has been that we pick a direction and then we stop and we go some other direction, and that way that's a guarantee to get nowhere.
Davey suspects the challenge will be in sorting out the details.
I think it's very likely we're getting a project that works. The question is how well will it work and how fast will we be able to build out and those kinds of questions. Those are they're kind of operational questions.
Davies also points to Interior Energy Project installed distribution lines already in the ground in North Pole that, if supplied with gas, could provide area residents an alternative to wood heating and reduce wintertime fine particulate pollution.
That pipe was put there. That was the priority was put there because of the air quality issues that are out there.
Our air quality has to change.
Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation CEO Jim Dodson says addressing air quality and the cost of energy through the Interior Energy Project is Fairbanks' best path forward.
We can make this our project, and that $325 million that Fairbanks got to do this, even though it wasn't enough money, it is a darn good start. And by the way, it's the only start we've ever had.
Dodson says the project is the first time the state has invested in energy for Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, Dan Bross.
Leadership at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game got an earful Tuesday night in Palmer. That's where the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's Fish Commission told Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton and other top officials about what the borough describes as a chronic failure to let fish pass through Cook Inlet to the Matsu's rivers and creeks. For years, Matsu anglers and sport fishing guides have been at odds with commercial fishing interests farther south in Cook Inlet. They say the commercial drift netters are catching salmon headed to the Matsu to spawn and that their fishing opportunities have been more limited. Fish and Game, they say, has tended to use its discretion in interpreting regulations to benefit the commercial fishers. Eric Spade was one of those who testified.
Some of you guys had to lose your job because it's been like some really bad management. Last year was horrible.
Matsu officials admit that a fairly strong run of silver salmon arrived in area waterways in the past week, but they say earlier in the fishing season, the popular Little Susitna River was closed to bait fishing for other species and counts remained low for silvers there. The only air carrier for the Pribilof Islands is asking for financial support to keep its remote market afloat. Penair has requested the U.S. Department of Transportation subsidize flights to St. Paul and St. George Islands, which are guaranteed essential air service. Spokesperson Missy Roberts says Penair wants to continue serving the Pribilofs, which it's done for nearly 60 years. But she says the company needs help after filing for bankruptcy protection earlier this month. If the DOT does subsidize those routes, other airlines will be allowed to bid on them. Roberts says Penair hopes to win the contract with community support. While that process plays out, service to St. Paul and St. George will continue as usual. Customers can still book flights and existing reservations will not be affected. Penair has made the same subsidy request for its McGrath route. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau residents are embracing a rainbow painted crosswalk. The city streets department, not so much.
Crosswalk lines are to be white, and it's in bold and in the regulation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A longtime Alaska political and business leader is fighting prostate cancer. Former Senator Albert Kukesh, an Angoon Democrat, spent 16 years in the Alaska legislature. As a senator, he represented the state's largest electoral district, which ran from southern southeast through the interior and most of the way to the Bering Sea. Kukesh also served as co-chairman of the Alaska Federation of Natives and president of the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation's board of directors. The Tlingit leader is also a subsistence activist who's played leadership roles in the Alaska Native Brotherhood and other organizations. Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson says Kukesh has been a mentor to many tribal and community leaders.
I was a 19-year-old mayor in Kasan, and as our representative and then senator, you know, he was always there to offer advice, point us in the right direction, and really make sure that we knew how to advocate for our community.
Kukesh is being recognized at a medical fundraiser and appreciation dinner Friday in Juneau. The Central Council is a sponsor, along with Sea Alaska Corporation and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Peterson says the event is more about recognition of decades of work than raising money for treatment.
Albert's not asking for this. This is really our community coming together and saying, hey, we want to hold he and Sally up, their children up while they go through this fight.
Sally is Kukesh's wife. He could not be reached for immediate comment. The Angoon resident spent 8 years in the House and the same number in the Senate. He lost a re-election bid in 2012 after reapportionment pitted him against Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican. The new district included more of Stedman's constituents than Kukesh's. Kukesh spent 14 years chairing Sea Alaska's growing governing panel. He stepped down in 2014 after a heart attack, though he remains on the board where he served for 40 years. He also chose not to run for re-election as AFN co-chair that year, a position he held for 14 years. Kukesh has a law degree, was a commercial fisherman, and owned a lodge and store in Angoon. A state court judge has agreed to dismiss a lawsuit that prompted the state medical board to adopt new regulations for abortions after the first trimester in Alaska. Attorneys for Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands and for the state had jointly sought dismissal of the case brought by Planned Parenthood. They said the lawsuit was rendered moot by the medical board's actions. The lawsuit filed last year had been on hold pending final actions by the medical board. The new regulations took effect in July. The medical board cast the changes in part as an effort to modernize the rules. On Thursday, Superior Court Judge Eric Arseth signed an order dismissing the case. Each side is to be responsible for its own fees and costs. 6 days after forming an emergency response team, officials have suspended their efforts aboard a disabled fishing vessel in Unalaska. Coast Guard Petty Officer John Paul Rios says responders have removed almost 16,000 gallons of oil and sludge from the FV Accutan, which is moored in Captain's Bay.
The main thing that we were trying to do was just ensure that there was no major pollution incident. At this time, we feel confident that we've mitigated any kind of imminent threat to pollution.
Rio says it's still unclear what will happen to the floating processor in the long term. There are 130,000 pounds of frozen sockeye on board following the Accutan's failed salmon season in Bristol Bay.
As far as ownership or who's responsible from here on out, I don't necessarily have the right answer for you.
While responders have scaled back their operations, Rio says they're still on the island monitoring the situation, ready to intervene again if necessary. Rural health aides have a long, successful history of improving access to health care in Alaska. That includes dental care. The Dental Health Aid Therapist Program was controversial when it started a decade ago, but a new study suggests smiles have gotten healthier, cleaner, and toothier in villages where it's appeared. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Felicia Wild grew up in Mountain Village on the Yukon River. When she was 12, she got a toothache. It started small, but soon she couldn't sleep. With the pain, she began missing school. Then a dentist arrived for the village's yearly dental visit.
And I was entered into that list to get seen, but the list was so long, it was like 4 or 5 pages of patients.
Wild didn't make the cut. She had to fly to Bethel for treatment, and by then, the tooth had abscessed or become infected.
And it was on a permanent tooth that had a huge cavity, and I needed a root canal.
If Wild had had a dental provider in her village, she says the problem may never have occurred. Now, Wild herself is a provider. She works as a certified dental health aid therapist for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. After training for 2 years, she offers many of the services of dentists, like x-rays, fillings, and extractions. This program was started by the state's tribal health organizations because nothing else was working. Dentists were willing to travel to rural areas and donate services, but it was never enough. National Dental Group sued to stop the program, saying it wouldn't be safe. They lost, and the program began turning out trained health aides capable of doing dental therapy.
Dental therapists seem to be making a difference in terms of providing the type of care that you and I would want for ourselves and maybe family members.
Dr. Donald Chi is an associate professor of dentistry at University of Washington. He's a pediatric dentist who's practiced in the YK Delta, and recently he published a study evaluating the impact of dental therapists on Delta communities. The findings are significant.
The more number of dental therapist treatment days communities got, the more preventive care people got, and fewer people were getting extractions.
The study is the first long-term review of health impacts by dental therapists, and Dr. Chi says the results could change the way dental care is provided in rural areas across the U.S. Dr. Judith Burks coordinates YKHC's 10 dental therapists. She's seen the transformation.
I go out to villages, and instead of the main focus being on emergencies, we get to focus on things like prevention and higher level care for the patients.
In other words, dental therapists can now educate communities on how to live healthier lifestyles for a healthier mouth, like not using tobacco and avoiding sugar. Dental therapist Felicia Wild knows her efforts mean villagers are seeing less of the pain, sleepless nights, and missed school days like she experienced growing up.
It's been awesome just seeing the patients and their gratitude. That feeling is just amazing.
YKHC hopes to nearly double the number of dental therapists serving the region over the next 2 years. They're offering full scholarships, and applications will be available on the YKHC website in February. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
An expansion of the state's largest hydroelectric facility is a step closer to reality. The Alaska Energy Authority's Board of Directors approved a $46 million expansion of the Bradley Lake at its meeting earlier this month. The Battle Creek Project, as it's known, will divert runoff from the Battle Glacier, just upstream of the Bradley Lake Dam. Water will be diverted through a pipeline stretching nearly 2 miles. The state-owned facility serves about 70% of Alaska's population through 6 electric utilities along the rail belt. Each utility plays a role in operating Bradley Lake, and the nearly 370 megawatts it produces each year are divvied up between providers. AEA Chief Operating Officer Kirk Warren says the diversion will boost production at the site by 10%, but more importantly, it will help maintain water levels during the summer months.
The utilities have to maintain a minimum water level, and when it gets down to that, they will have to decrease power coming from Bradley Lake. So this will allow situations where they can get more power during times where historically they haven't been able to.
There is a lot to figure out before the project's expected completion in 2020, and funding is the largest hurdle. The AEA board examined 5 options. The board intends to seek most of its funding through new clean energy bonds, federal money set aside by the Obama administration for renewable energy projects. Warren says the board is looking to secure funding this fall. Waiting could lead to higher interest rates. A 1% increase could tack on $10 million.
That's the impetus for us to make the decision as quickly as possible. There's no reason we have to believe that that interest rate would ever go down. So the quicker we make a decision with regards to getting that RFP in the street and locking in that interest rate, the better.
There has also been talk of the Chugach Electric Association financing the project. The wholesale price of electricity from Bradley Lake is expected to increase slightly, but hydroelectric power is typically cheaper than traditional power sources. AEA expects a more consistent supply from Bradley Lake will in turn save electric utilities money. Bidding is expected to open in October, and work is likely to begin next spring.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The State Department of Fish and Game will close the popular Macomb caribou season one day early this year because hunters have already had a lot of success with harvesting bulls. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Delta Junction area wildlife biologist Bob Schmidt says as of Thursday, hunters who stalk their prey on foot had already harvested 34 bulls from the Macomb caribou herd since the season opened on August 10th. That's more than half of this season's quota of 60, so he says Fish and Game will end the hunt at midnight Saturday, leaving hunters who use motorized vehicles only one day to bag a bull.
Typically half the harvest comes those two motorized days. So, you know, with already being at 34, if we let it go both motorized days, that, you know, could get 10 or more over.
Schmidt says Fish and Game wants to keep this season's take of bulls as close to 60 as possible to maintain the population of the Macomb herd, which had bounced back this year and grown to about 1,200.
The highest has been at 1,500, you know, a few years back, but then it dipped down to 700 or 800 for the last 2 years. And so that's why we had the conservative quota of 40 last year, but now this year, with it being a little higher again, we bumped it back up to 60.
The Macomb caribou herd usually ranges from the Delta River west of Donnelly Flats to Yerrick Creek near Tok. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A crosswalk in a downtown Juneau neighborhood is constantly being painted over in rainbow colors. It's an expression of creativity or simple vandalism, depending on who you ask. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
The corner of 7th and Gold isn't particularly busy. One of its crosswalks has been getting a fair amount of attention since someone began painting a rainbow over the white lines. Sue Warner lives two doors down.
Well, the first time I saw it, I was kind of having a hard time, and I was walking to work on a sunny morning, and it just was bright and cheerful, and it made me smile. And then I've watched other people stop and take pictures and point to it, and just, I see it makes everybody smile. It's a bright, cheerful color.
The city had the crosswalk repainted. That was last summer.
The manual for uniform traffic control devices doesn't give us an option. Crosswalk lines are to be white, and it's in bold and in the regulation.
That's the city's street superintendent, Ed Foster.
So they have to be white, and that's based on studies that they've done to determine that the white is more visible than any other color. So they have to be white.
It didn't end there. The rainbow has been reappearing. Each time it does, the city has to repaint. It's happened at least 3 times this summer. Foster says it's getting ridiculous and expensive.
We contract out the roadway painting to a contractor, and they charge us $195 for every crosswalk.
An email list maintained by the Downtown Juneau Neighborhood Association lit up this month with discussion about the fate of the rainbow. It found many fans. There's been at least one offer to pony up hundreds of dollars for the city's expense to date if they'll just leave it alone. But Foster says if people want to petition the assembly for a variance to allow multicolored crosswalks, they can. Otherwise, it's just vandalism.
I mean, it's no different than somebody takes a spray can and starts painting light poles, trash cans, power transformers. It's graffiti. and we're going to clean it up.
The identity of the gorilla crosswalk painter or painters isn't known. There's been no claim of responsibility, no manifesto left at the scene. Neighbors Sue Warner says she appreciates the effort, whoever might be responsible.
I don't know who's painting it, and I mean, the more color in our lives in this gray town, the better.
But the city's streets department isn't amused anymore. Foster has this simple plea.
Please stop painting over the white paint.
In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska can be really rainy in August, but Ketchikan is going above and beyond in the wet weather category. The city had more than 7 inches of rain in a 24-hour period earlier this week. Alaska's Energy Desk checks in with climatologist Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brettschneider tells editor Annie Feit Ketchikan is already the rainiest city in the country, and August is adding up to be a very wet month.
For the first 22 days of August, Ketchikan has had about 16.5 inches of rain, and normally they only have about 6.25. So in terms of the raw precipitation total, they're leading the way in the state, but also in the percent of normal. So that's more than 2.5 times what they would normally expect. Now remember, August is really, really wet. It's the wettest month of the year for much of mainland Alaska. Down in southeast, August really isn't one of the top 3 or 4 wettest months. That's more going to be September, October. So 16 inches of rain in a month for Ketchikan, not very uncommon, but in August, it's really, really uncommon.
Yeah, so they're not even in their wettest month, and they're getting crazy amounts of rain.
Yeah, they don't really peak until October. So once they get into October, 16, 17 inches of rain, not a big deal. But in August, it's really, really something that they're not used to dealing with.
And what about the rest of the state?
Well, pretty much most of the state is above normal. There are some areas like Nome and Kotzebue and Haines, Skagway, that are a little bit below normal. But then there's a lot of places that are really way above normal. So most of the mainland, except for the West Coast, is above normal to significantly above normal. Up on the North Slope, so a little bit above normal. And then the southern half of Southeast is very much above normal. So pretty much everyone's getting in on the rain action this month.
And why is it so wet this time of year in Alaska?
Well, a large percentage of our annual precipitation falls in August, September, October. So those 90 days, for many places, they receive more than half their annual precipitation, even as much as like 60% in parts of the interior. In those 3 months. And what we have is the hemispheric patterns start to shift, where you get cooling off of high latitudes, but it's still warm in low latitudes. So you end up with the long wave patterns starting to shift, and the early onset of the North Pacific and Aleutian low pressure system. And as that starts to develop, you get southwesterly flow coming around the eastern side of that. And that sends lots of moisture and disturbances into the state, and we just get lots of rain out of that.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Casey Grove and Annie Feit in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.